Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Order is restored. Two guests today. Heidi Matthews will explain what the World Court is all about in general, and then specifically what the cases against Israel mean. And in a detour off the usual Behind the News beaten track, Elijah Wald will look into the world of Jelly Roll Morton, one that has come down to us in a highly sanitized version. Doctrinaire Marxist that I am, I don't normally give much thought to institutions like the International Court of Justice, a.k.a. the World Court. International relations strikes me as the realm of pure power politics, and legal niceties just don't count for much. But I was surprised by the political effect of the court's decision in January, based on a case brought by South Africa, that there was a plausible case that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. The decision didn't stop the genocide, and as you'll hear from my first question to Heidi Matthews, my skepticism survives despite these political effects. But it did move public opinion some, and not just popular opinion, but apparently elite opinion as well. And now Nicaragua has filed suit against Germany for supplying weapons to Israel, further complicating the lives of the genocideurs and their enablers. Here to explain these judicial goings-on is Heidi Matthews. She is an assistant professor at the Osgoode Hall Law School of York University in Toronto. Among her specialties are international criminal law and the law of war, meaning that unlike many people who opine on these topics, she actually knows what she's talking about. When Heidi says today, she's referring to Tuesday, April 9th, when this interview was recorded. Heidi Matthews. Let's start with some general questions about the ICJ. Every time I hear about it, I'm reminded of Stalin's famous question about the Pope. How many divisions has the Pope? How many divisions has the ICJ? What weight does decisions have?
It's great to be back, Doug. Yeah, I mean, it depends on who you ask, I think, right? I mean, the main thing to say about the ICJ is it's the main judicial organ of the United Nations, okay? So if you're a person who has an affinity with, broadly speaking, the rules-based international legal order, something like that, then you have some kind of a commitment to the organs of the UN and their good functioning, and then the ICJ is the world court. Right? For that reason. So what does that mean? It means that it decides disputes between states. So states appear kind of as though they were individuals and they get to sue each other and stuff. And it's, they've been doing that since the beginning of the UN. And preceding the ICJ, of course, was the Permanent Court of International Justice. But if you're somebody who is quite skeptical of the UN, whether you're on the right or the left, then you're going to be a little bit less persuaded by the work of the ICJ, and you see that filtering down into state opinions. And so Israel itself, since that's the topic, broadly speaking, for today, has never really had any trust in the ICJ, and for that reason...
Quite the contrary, they hate everything about the UN, don't they?
Yeah. And the way that plays out legally is that they just don't consent to the jurisdiction of the ICJ in most cases. And so, you know, it's up to states, like it's a consent-based jurisdiction. And that's a big issue in the Nicaragua-Germany case that I assume we're going to talk about. And so generally, Israel doesn't consent to that jurisdiction. There are some cases where consent is not a prerequisite. South Africa's case is one of those. But, you know, I think on the bottom line is, who does it matter for? Well, it's a tool of politics, really. And it matters for the states that care about international law in some way. And it will be the object of derision for states who don't or who feel singled out in one way or another, like Israel and the United States and others.
Yeah, I was going to say, Israel's principal patron, the United States, also is not very fond of the ICJ,
no.
Right?
No. No.
So a bunch of scofflaws here we're talking about. Okay, now let's talk about the ruling against Israel. Weeks ago, months ago, I've lost all track of time.
In the South Africa case.
Yes, in the South Africa case. What exactly did that say? What was their finding?
Yeah, so this is from January 26th, so a while ago now, remarkably. And so that was an order for provisional measures. And what that means, it's a form of interim relief that states seek to protect the rights that they're trying to vindicate or in the period between the beginning of a case and when the case gets decided on the merits, and that takes a really long time generally. So South Africa requested a set of provisional measures in order to protect essentially the rights of the Palestinian people living in Gaza not to be subjected to genocide. That was the core ask. And there were several measures they thought would attain that. They asked for a ceasefire, immediate provision of humanitarian assistance, safeguarding of evidence, that kind of a thing. And so the basic story with the provisional measures order, and I think folks who've been following it are, you know, will have heard this sort of an odd phrase when it gets repeated, like in the media or whatever, the court found plausible genocide. And the reason why that language, that kind of odd language of plausibility is used, is because plausibility is the legal standard that's required to order provisional measures. So it's a standard that's much easier to pass than a standard required to actually prove a claim at the merit stage.
Now, will there be a final judgment where they will either prove or disprove that?
Yeah, sure. It'll take a while. So the case is ongoing. There was a second order of provisional measures. I think it was March 28th. It's the end of March. South Africa had gone back, and the court, mostly based on the factual finding that famine had actually started in parts of Gaza, went in and modified some of the measures. So there have actually been two orders now from the ICJ in that case.
And if the United States and Israel weren't such global scofflaws, what would the right thing to do be? Just stop it?
Like the genocide? Yeah.
That's the order, more or less, right?
It's a little hair splitty. So folks who were really excited about South Africa's case and the fact that it succeeded in getting these provisional measures ordered were mostly quite upset with the fact, or disappointed at least, with the fact that the ICJ did not order a ceasefire as was requested. South Africa and others have looked at the provisional measures and they've tried to like read in the requirement for a ceasefire. I'm not sure personally that that's a super fair reading. We could also read the situation simply as one of armed conflict. I mean, that's becoming increasingly implausible, but in any event, folks got a bit upset about that. But the basic takeaway is that Israel needs to stop creating a situation where a court could find plausible genocide. So in other words, where a court could say there's a very serious risk that genocide is either being committed in the present or is about to be committed. And so there's a lot of factual stuff that goes into that determination. South Africa brought a ton of evidence, a very long application, but the basic thing is the creation by Israel, essentially, of conditions of life calculated to bring about the destruction of the Palestinian people in whole or in part. That's the genocidal act that kind of, to my mind, best captures the situation in its totality.
And now South Africa bringing this case, and now we're going to talk about Nicaragua in a moment. Can any country bring such a suit, or do they have, you know, as in civil law, have to prove some sort of standing?
You do have to prove standing, yeah. And also there needs to be prima facie jurisdiction as well. And so otherwise the case is not considered admissible. And so there, those hurdles have to be met. Today, Germany defended itself in the Nicaragua case. And part of what it was arguing was that there actually wasn't a dispute. And so this is a procedural threshold for prima facie jurisdiction. There needs to be a dispute between the two states, right? So there needs to be a dispute between South Africa and Israel. There needs to be a dispute between Nicaragua and Germany. And Germany was saying, look, Nicaragua has basically fabricated the semblance of a dispute. It didn't even send its emails to Germany, you know, to the right email address. Like it literally said that.
Oh, man, that's dark.
Yeah, but your basic question is a little complicated, but the kind of rights that are being claimed in both cases are derived from what are called erga omnes obligations, and that's just a Latin word that means obligations that are in the common interest of all states in the international community. And it's easier in some ways to bring a case rooted in the Genocide Convention, because states are mostly all parties to the Genocide Convention, and there's a particular provision, an article of the Genocide Convention, that creates a jurisdictional anchor where it says that basically any claim related to a violation of the convention or interpretation of the convention can get resolved by the ICJ. So it's kind of its own separate process that's rooted in that treaty. And that's one reason why we see all of these genocide cases coming, you know, in the last 5 to 7 years or so with the ICJ.
What about responsibility to protect, the obligation to prevent genocide?
The broad obligation to prevent genocide, that's also enshrined in the Genocide Convention. The Genocide Convention lays out the definition of genocide, which has remained the same for many decades now. It's enshrined in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court as well. And it lays out what constitutes genocidal acts. It also talks about complicity in genocide. And it also talks about this broad obligation of all states who are party to the convention to prevent and punish acts of genocide. And that idea of prevention is core to both cases involving Israel right now at the ICJ.
Okay, so now we've got Nicaragua coming in. What was their angle against Germany?
Nicaragua alleges a few things. Its case is actually quite a bit broader than the South African case. So part of what Nicaragua is alleging is that Germany has failed in its duty to prevent and punish genocide. But it also alleges that Germany is contributing to the commission of genocide. In other words, that it's complicit in the commission of genocide in Gaza. But it goes further than that. It says that Germany has also failed in its duty not to recognize the illegal situation created by the occupation. It says that Germany has failed to prevent and, in fact, has assisted in the violation of the Palestinian people's right to self-determination, other violations of fundamental norms of international law, including grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, serious violations of the law of war, and also structural apartheid, which is a crime assessed as a sort of standalone crime against humanity.
Why just Germany? Why not the United States?
Yeah, so that's a jurisdictional thing. So we talked about this a bit at the beginning. So the United States has not, like Israel, has not accepted at this moment the compulsory jurisdiction of the court to resolve disputes between it and other states. So that's one reason why all of these broad claims couldn't be brought. Certainly a case under the Genocide Convention, I think, likely could have been brought. Yeah, so it's kind of an open question. Why single out Germany? I mean, Germany is the second largest supplier of military goods and technology to Israel. One thing that Nicaragua really pressed upon in their oral arguments yesterday at the court was this so-called like raison d'état that Germany has around the sort of unconditional support for Israel. It seemed particularly disturbed by that kind of general justification for Germany's attitude toward Israel. Yeah, but I mean, theoretically, a case could be brought against the U.S. for failing in its obligations as outlined in the Genocide Convention.
Yeah, I saw a friend last night who had just came back from a 9-month fellowship in Germany, and the atmosphere she described there was completely insane. I'm used to the Zionist police running around the U.S., but it seems like it's many times more intense in Germany right now.
It is very intense. Yeah.
I'm speaking with Heidi Matthews, assistant professor at Osgoode Hall Law School, York University, Toronto. So are any other countries now involved in suits or like amicus briefs or anything like that?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of interventions. And so what that means is it's a way for states to become involved in a case, even though they've not themselves initiated the case or are not themselves being accused in a case. Well, there's actually 3 cases concerning Israel, the ICJ right now. So the other one is it's an advisory opinion. So it's not a contentious case between states. It's something that the General Assembly has asked the court to opine on. And that's the legality or illegality of the prolonged occupation of the Palestinian territory. And so there are a massive number of interventions in that request for an advisory opinion. And we're seeing states intervene in both the South Africa case. Actually, I'm not sure if there are interventions in Nicaragua and Germany yet, but we are seeing states, including Germany and Nicaragua, on opposite sides intervening in South Africa versus Israel as well. So many states are getting in on the action, as it were.
And how is Germany defending itself?
The German case is interesting. So there's a few key points here. One is it's basically alleging that Nicaragua seriously misrepresented the facts about the nature of the arms trade between Germany and Israel at the moment. And so in particular, Germany forcefully argued today that in fact, the vast majority of its arms sales to Israel since October 7th happened in what it referred to as like the immediate aftermath or the immediate context of the Hamas attacks. And what it's trying to do there is to say, look, yeah, we sent all these, munitions and whatever, all kinds of other sorts of military support in that period. But that made sense because it was clear to everybody, and this is kind of how the line of argument goes, it was sort of clear to everybody that Israel's claim to self-defense was like incontestable or strong at that point in time. And then that claim has diminished considerably as the months have wore on in this nightmare.
That's an interesting concession, though.
It is. I think it's really interesting. And it's particularly interesting because part of domestic law, and this is to comply with the ATT, so International Arms Trade Treaty, right, requires that states have a domestic procedure before they authorize exports of military goods and technology for assessing whether there's a likelihood that those goods would be used to commit serious violations of international law. So the US has a procedure for doing that. The UK has a procedure, Canada, whatever, all states, Germany has a you know, fairly intricate administrative procedure for making those assessments. And it seems to me anyway, and they didn't come out and say this today, but it seemed to me that essentially Germany was sort of admitting or impliedly conceding, as you say, that it has assessed internally that there is a serious risk now that Israel is using armaments or weapons transfers to commit serious violations of international law. And again, of course, it didn't come out and say that, but it was very, very careful to make a distinction between the categories that are in internal to German domestic law. So the first category is what it calls war weapons. Like there's a German word for that, right? But war weapons versus other kinds of military material. And it's the vast majority of transfers have been in this other category. Canada also has been using kind of a slippery distinction between what it calls lethal and non-lethal goods and technology. Yeah, so that's kind of the main claim, is that it's just a factual one, meaning that, lots and lots of transfers were made, a huge amount in October and into November. But since then, the transfers have been primarily in this other category.
It fits in with the line that, you know, in the initial days, you could argue, I wouldn't argue, but you could, I guess, plausibly argue that Israel was defending itself. But after a few days, it just became a war of destruction and revenge.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that's something that the court would have to decide. So the court, the first or the main part of the test, the legal test, when it comes to the question of whether provisional measures should be ordered, is whether the rights sought to be protected by the applicant state are plausible. So we're back to this plausibility threshold. So the question factually for the court will be like, okay, is it plausible that that massive amount of armaments, which consisted of so-called war weapons, were transferred without the requisite knowledge that they were likely to be used in the commission of serious violations of international law?
I have to look up what the German word for that is. It does seem like a very German concept. Okay, another couple of legal questions while I've got you on the line. One, Israel's frequent claim that Hamas uses civilians as human shields. Now, whether that's true or not is a separate question, but even if that is true, does that justify attacking the civilians, even if, you know, they are being used as human shields?
No. The short answer is no. And there's a lot of like conflation happening in the public sphere, a lot of conflation around self-defense. So what does the argument from self-defense actually authorize? Can it ever authorize violations of the law of war? The answer is no. But the same thing for the right of resistance, that also cannot authorize attacking civilians, et cetera, right? So it's the two sides of the same coin. But when it comes to human shields, yeah, like oftentimes we see this argument that, so let's assume that human shields, and it's a very specific category actually in international law, and it's sort of used in a much broader way than actually makes sense legally. But again, we'll set that aside for a second. Let's just assume that there's like widespread human shielding taking place in Gaza. That doesn't authorize Israel to knowingly attack civilians or civilian objects. In other words, human shields themselves, whether it's a person or if you're going to speak a little bit more metaphorically, is like, you know, civilian infrastructure, like a hospital or school or whatever. None of that becomes a legitimate military target just because it's, again, just assuming for sake of argument that there is actually human shielding going on. The only kind of change in circumstances which can justify the transformation of a civilian or civilian infrastructure into a legitimate target is if the civilian takes a direct part in hostilities, right? And so therefore it loses their civilian status, or you know, the building or infrastructure is used to create or to partake in acts that are considered harmful to the enemy. So those are actually like separate determinations. And even if that's found, right? Like, so even if a hospital becomes dual use because it's performing humanitarian services and, you know, life-saving medical work is going on there, but it's also being used to make a serious contribution to acts that are harmful to the enemy, as the language goes, the attacking party, like Israel here, right, still is under an obligation to take all feasible precautions to limit harm to civilians, to distinguish between the civilian population and combatants, and to not engage in attacks or targeting activities that have harm to civilians that is disproportionate, or in the sense that it's excessive when compared to the military direct and concrete military advantage anticipated.
You can't bomb a hospital because there are Hamas tunnels underneath.
It gets a little bit tricky, and it comes down to, there are violations also of international law, and it's only once they reach a certain threshold of severity that they could then constitute war crimes. I mean, I think the thing about the law of war that folks don't often recognize is that it does actually authorize a tremendous amount of civilian harm. So it's not like we can turn to the law of war as like some kind of like moral savior. It's not actually a terribly moral body of law. It's designed to protect strong states against weak, oppressed, insurgent groups, that kind of a thing, right? Like, it was designed by states for states to further state power. And, you know, in that constellation, obviously, is designed for stronger states. So I don't think we should portray international humanitarian law as like a particularly moral body of law. It isn't. And there are circumstances where you could bomb a tunnel, but you know, a calculus has to be made. And that's the slippery thing about the law, because there's no mathematical equation for figuring out how many dead children is too many dead children, frankly. Pretty gruesome stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and then finally, 972's story about Israel's use of AI in choosing targets. Some of my comrades in the far left here have been reading this as an attempt by Israel to deflect responsibility, blaming it on machines rather than people. Now, it seems to me that responsibility for a system like this, and the cynicism to call it "Where's Daddy," would go high up the military and political command chain.
Yeah.
And it's not a defense at all. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. So the thing about the law of war is that, or all law in general, is that it's always playing catch up. And that's true with respect to technology, but it's true with all kinds of other social and cultural developments in the world. So, you know, my basic point is that we don't have a law of war that was ever written in anticipation of this kind of technology. We don't really have a legal framework that is able to take into consideration all of the factors that go into that. Folks in the law of war world, and including like military folks, have been concerned for, you know, a decade or more about automated killing. And so we used to talk about that. You might remember this language around like killer robots. The idea that the basic worry there was that you'd be able to come up with like a killing machine, like some kind of robotic drone-based whatever mechanism that could make lethal decisions without a human being involved. So there is a decision being made, but it's not a decision really because it's automated. I think that report said that like 10% of the targeting decisions at minimum were an error. Error being whatever that means, but let's just take the IDF said that, in fact, right? I mean, it kind of operated on the basic knowledge that there was this margin of error that was quite large. So you're quite right. So that means that the state is operating in the knowledge that the decision-making automated mechanism it's employing has a considerable rate of error. And that in and of itself is hugely disturbing. It's all really about knowledge. And the state knows what it's doing when it deploys these machine-facilitated means of killing.
Yeah, it's just viscerally revolting.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like really dystopian, but on the other hand, what's more revolting, like having this kind of automated thing running in the background, making these decisions, or having human beings who are willing to sit there and themselves make the decision in a way that's problematic, in a way that doesn't sufficiently distinguish between civilians and combatants and everything. So I think, you know, all of it's really problematic, and putting too much weight on the technology part as the moral problem is also, I think, maybe a little bit dangerous.
That was Heidi Matthews, assistant professor at the Osgoode Hall Law School of York University in Toronto. You're listening to Behind the News on Jacobin Radio. My name is Doug Henwood, back after a musical break.
This is the first blues I have no doubt heard in my life. Mamie Desdoom, this was her favorite blues. She hardly could play anything else more, but she really could play this note. Of course, to get in on it, to try to learn it, I made myself the can rusher. 219 done took my baby away. '219 took my babe away. '217 bring her back someday.
That was some of Mamie's blues, performed by Jelly Roll Morton. Mamie was Mamie Desdunes, a pianist and a singer from New Orleans, born 1879, who lost a couple of fingers in an accident, which is why, as Morton said, she couldn't play much. But as he said at the beginning of the song, it was the first blues he heard in his life and may have been one of the first instances of the classic 12-bar blues form. This version is on the album Last Sessions, the complete general recordings, recorded in 1939, 2 years before Morton's death. I played the song to introduce my next guest, Elijah Wald, a musician and historian with over a dozen books to his name. The latest is the just-published Jelly Roll Blues, Censored Songs and Hidden Histories, a marvelous look at the world of early blues and jazz, mostly in New Orleans, centered on the figure of Jelly Roll Morton, born in that city in 1890. Morton developed his skills as a pianist in bordellos, and as we'll hear, the early evolution of that music was tightly associated with the world of sex work. A history that has largely been effaced by moralizers. Elijah Wald. Who was Jelly Roll Morton?
Jelly Roll Morton is best known as really the first great composer and arranger in jazz, the first person to not just put a bunch of people in a room and get them blowing, but to actually, you know, write out the parts and have everybody have a different voice, and yet to keep all the energy of the old style. But that was really his third career. Before that, he was a vaudeville comedian. And before that, he was a piano player and blues singer. And what I was doing in my book was going back to that earliest period, because when he talks about that, it's really the best picture we have anywhere of the first period of blues, which is the period at the very beginning of the 20th century.
Okay, now the recordings that provide the structure for your book. What's the story around them?
Well, in 1938, Morton had fallen on hard times. He was running a little club in Washington, D.C. and playing some piano. And some white jazz fans discovered him and started coming down. And they brought down Alan Lomax from the Library of Congress. And interestingly, Morton was the one who had the idea, hey, if there's this guy from the Library of Congress, he needs to record me because I know the whole history of jazz and it should be documented at the Library of Congress. And so he showed up and said that to Lomax. And Lomax's initial reaction was, I'm not interested in jazz, but he thought he'd give it a shot. And they began doing a first session, and Lomax just realized he was dealing with one of the most brilliant storytellers, musicians, and someone who really, really knew where all of that had started.
The name Jelly Roll points to a lot of your story. What does it mean?
Well, the name Jelly Roll was a sexual euphemism. I think it was generally used for female genitalia, but it also could mean male genitalia. I mean, either way, you can think of it as a roll filled with cream, heaven help us. And so, yeah, it was, and then by extension, it simply became a euphemism for having sex. Who's going to do your sweet jelly roll? And when I'm gone, I'm a jelly roll baker, bake the best jelly roll in town. There were infinite songs on that theme.
And this, of course, is a lot of the history that is sanitized or forgotten in the way it's been received since.
Well, I think most people knew that euphemism. The thing that's been sanitized and forgotten is that early blues was not euphemistic. That as long as blues was not being commodified, was not being sold on sheet music or on records, but was just being sung in bars, it used the same language that people use in bars. That's the oddity, you know, that's essentially what I was going into in my book, is that all the blues we have recorded is the blues that was cleaned up to not just sound the way people talk in bars. And Morton recorded all these early blues pieces in 1938 that did not get released for the first time for over 50 years because he was using words that you're not allowed to use, you know. Am I allowed to say them in your context?
I'm afraid not. This is radio, and the FCC does not like these words. So,
yeah. So, I mean, the interesting thing to me about when I started looking into all the other material that had been censored is that a lot of it, we're not talking about dirty songs. When, for example, Jelly Roll Morton is using what we will delicately call the F word, it isn't that he's singing sexual stuff. He has this long song called The Murder Ballad, and it's I'll cut your effing throat and drink your blood like wine. It's barroom talk, or in the modern day, hip-hop talk, rap talk, and which, of course, is a huge part of this project for me. It's just the idea that, first of all, he was using that language. Second of all, he was famous for what we now call freestyling, for just improvising rhymes and lyrics infinitely.
Yeah, you make the point frequently that there's a lot in common between this that old blues culture and rap culture today, right?
Yeah, I mean, I in fact would say that rap culture today is simply the surfacing of something that has been around, that has been being done by Black entertainers for Black audiences since at least the 1890s. And that we simply lost that because there was no way of preserving it. The folklorists didn't preserve it. The commercial record people didn't preserve it. And so we got this idea, oh my God, nobody ever talked that way or did those kind of themes or in those days. And of course they did. And of course, improvisation is what you can't preserve.
Yeah, this, as you say, people often think of improvisation as primarily an instrumental thing, but in fact, the improvisation with words predates it. And this culture you write about, the use of language was extravagantly rich and inventive.
Absolutely. No, I mean, that's what the most famous, the most popular people in terms of outstanding soloists on the New Orleans jazz scene, many of them were people who were known for improvising lyrics. And that, as you just said, that predated the popularity of improvising melodies. I think partly because you can tell. I mean, I don't know how many of your listeners have ever been to a rap battle, but I mean, when people are improvising lyrics, they're improvising about what's happening in the room around them, and you can tell that it's improvised and not something they prepared. Whereas when somebody's improvising music, you can't tell if someone is improvising. I know there are critics who think they can, but any musician can fool them.
Some of the words you use, some of the words that are important in your book have evolved over time. Let's talk about those some. The word blues, for example, it didn't mean what it does to us moderns at first, right?
Well, I think the earliest use of blues that seems to have been standard was for a slow dance rhythm. And a lot of the early things that were called blues didn't have lyrics at all. They were just, it was, you know, sort of the very slow, sexy dance rhythm that people, that particularly they would play late at night, apparently largely for audiences of the sex workers, which is one of the things that got to fascinating me, that it was to a large extent music made for the women who were doing sex work after the customers had gone home.
And then it came to mean the form of the classic lyric pattern, the first line repeated and then a third line in response.
You're describing now the 12-bar blues, and that became sort of canonized by, I don't know that before the 1930s anyone really thought of that as, would say that's not a blues if it wasn't a 12-bar blues. Yeah, it became a whole variety of things. I mean, by the 1920s, it was sort of thought of as the pop style that black women sang. I mean, it was sort of what in white culture was called torch songs, that people, Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, Ida Cox, became big stars, and it was called blues. And blues, in that case, was really whatever those women sang was called blues. And then you get the next bunch, which are the men like Blind Lemon Jefferson, and what they did was called blues because it was sold as an equivalent of what the women had been doing. Any of these two terms, classical, rock, jazz, pop, these are just marketing terms. They don't really describe the music.
And jazz, that word has also evolved over time.
Yes, jazz simply meant having sex. I mean, to jazz somebody, and I ran across numerous interviews with older guys who said, I don't use that word in front of women, by which they meant nice women.
Yeah, and then it got really sanitized over time or gentrified over time.
Absolutely. I mean, jazz hit as a national craze in 1916, 1917, and actually hit following blues. In fact, the first article that ever mentions jazz as music, the headline was Jazz is Blues and Blues is Jazz.
And funk, that's a word with a rich history.
Yeah, funk originally seems to have just meant strong smells and particularly the smell of tobacco. It apparently existed already in French, but just meant, you know, sort of very thick air. You know, the first example we have in English is somebody talking about what it's like in the hold of a ship that's crowded with people and the funk being the air. And that was still how people were using it in New Orleans, was to mean, you know, something that was smelly. And there was the song Funky Butt that was a really popular song. And Buddy Bolden, who's often called the leader of the first jazz band, his theme song was a thing called Funky Butt, and there was a Funky Butt Hall that was one of the popular jazz rooms in New Orleans. And that was all about, you know, just being in a place where people who had been working all day or doing sex work were crowded together with no air conditioning, and, you know, it was smelly. I mean, one of the odd things I found when I was doing this is New Orleans didn't have clean running water until 1909. It was the last city in the United States to get that. So, you know, I suspect some of those rooms were pretty strong.
Funky. You mentioned this already, but let's develop it. The history that you're writing about is very much wrapped up with sex work, right? Describe the role of sex work in this community.
Well, that's interesting because people don't really understand how popular prostitution was at the turn of the century, in the 1890s, up to about 1915. I mean, to give an example, New York, the Tenderloin, which was the largest of the five prostitution districts in New York, ran for about two or three blocks wide, pretty much from 14th Street up to 50th or thereabout. Some blocks had as many as eight houses on them. It was a huge, huge, very visible business. And in black culture, it was a huge source of income, not just in terms of the sex work, but because the black sex districts brought in huge amounts of white money, paying not only for the sex, but for alcohol, tobacco, restaurants, musicians. Henry Townsend, the St. Louis blues player, gives this whole list of all the ways the black community profited from the money that the sex districts brought in. And it also was a place for independent entrepreneurs. I mean, there are amazing stories. I didn't get all of them in my book, but I was reading a story from Virginia of a woman and her daughter, black, who the older woman had been born in slavery, and who already by the 1870s owned numerous houses, not just of prostitution. She had started doing real estate because it also was a way of getting access. As a prostitute, she had access to wealthy white men who realized she was smart and started bankrolling her other projects. It's a complicated world. And one of the things I was trying to make clear in the book is that we are so used to hearing about sex workers as victims, which is accurate. I'm not saying that's wrong at all. But in a situation where black women in general were being constantly victimized, it was also a place where they could reach a level of power that they simply couldn't reach in pretty much any other profession that was open to them.
I'm speaking with Elijah Wald, author of Jelly Roll Blues, Censored Songs and Hidden Histories, just out from Hachette Books. And their money, the sex workers' money, was also important for helping the musicians pay their bills.
Well, that's the other thing. Yes, that musicians, I mean, Louis Armstrong was always eloquent about this. I mean, Louis Armstrong's mother and his first wife were both sex workers. And he always said, first of all, that they were completely respected in the community. And second of all, that it was not just that you could get money from them, but that it was a mark of status, that all the musicians in his world, you were expected to have a girlfriend who was a sex worker and who bought you nice clothes and so forth. Because, I mean, they made infinitely more money than any musician.
The songs about sex work, as you point out, they focus on both the sex and the work parts.
Yeah, and I would say, in fact, very little on the sex. I mean, most of the blues songs about sex work are, I mean, the famous one, the one that Jelly Roll Morton did one version of, Mamie's Blues, he called it, because he learned it from a woman, a part-time sex worker named Mamie Desdunes. Is, you know, if you can't spend, the woman who's walking the street, and if you can't spend a dollar, give me a lousy dime, I gotta feed that hungry man of mine. And you have versions of that all over the United States. There was a song called Tricks Ain't Walking No More that became particularly popular in the Depression about women out looking for tricks, and that the tricks aren't out there anymore. The blues songs about sex work overwhelmingly are simply about the business aspect of it.
The women in this world are often quite forward about being sexual creatures, quite assertive and rude about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not a world, you know, it's a world where sex was simply part of the norm. I mean, they sing about sex, they sing about the pleasures of sex. One of the interesting things, again, that makes me think that a lot of the early blues was written for the women, is the extent to the number of songs that are about lesbianism or about cunnilingus, I mean, which are the subjects of sort of if a sex worker has gotten off work and no longer has to worry about pleasing men, where suddenly things get interesting.
So a lot of this history got faced or sanitized. How'd that happen? Who are the agents? What was the audience that was intended for?
Well, I think, first of all, it had to get sanitized exactly the same way the recording we're making right now has to get sanitized. They were legal barriers. You could not print those words in any book that would be sent through the mails or any recording that would be sent through the mails. So all of just sort of the normal language of bars could not be preserved except in archives for scholars. But I think that there's then the other thing that the history of jazz, the history of blues has overwhelmingly been written by white men. And when they think about these kinds of subjects, there's a tendency for them to slip into their own fantasies where they imagine themselves, you know, down on Basin Street, reclining in armchairs, listening to jazz and with beautiful Creole belles, lighting their cigars for them and handing them glasses of champagne. So the picture of the world as it looked from the point of view of the musicians and the workers, which is to say the black people in that world, it's a very different picture. And that's what I was trying to do in the book, was not so much say, hey, look at all these weird songs or all these naughty songs or all these rowdy songs, but to say, let's take a look at all these songs that we've never looked at and try to figure out what world they're coming from. Treat them as voices from a vanished world, basically.
Which isn't to take away from the fact that they are often quite inventive and wonderful to read.
Oh, yeah, and funny and brilliant. I mean, that's part of it, that vanished world was not a world of stupid people. The top musicians and the top sex workers, we're talking about very smart people who are constantly having to improvise not only their lyrics and their music, but every aspect of their lives. I mean, one of the characters who to me is just one of the great discoveries of this project was a woman named Ready Money, who literally there has not been a single paragraph ever written about her before. And she was a nationally famous.
How did you find her?
Jelly Roll Morton referred to her, and Danny Barker, who was a great singer, songwriter, and banjo player in New Orleans somewhat later, but he then wrote some memoirs of New Orleans, mentioned her. And then crazily enough, you know, every name that I came across, we are now living in a time where you can put them into newspaper databases. And I never expected that one to actually lead anywhere. But as it turned out, she was famous. And luckily enough, when she was first arrested in New Orleans, the Picayune, I think it was the Picayune, it might have been the Times, in any case, wrote this long story about this woman who had just been arrested and who had previously been arrested in St. Louis and Kansas City and Chicago and Portland, Oregon, and Hot Springs, Arkansas, under various names. And so then I could go back and look in the newspapers under all those various names in all those various cities. And found it. But the crazy thing is then I followed the story forward and she ended up owning the largest black-owned hotel between LA and Tijuana in San Diego, a place called the Douglas Hotel, with a staff of 60 people and a nightclub with a full big band downstairs.
Wow.
And, you know, that was the sort of thing that fascinated me, was that here we have someone who was running a small house on Bienville Street in New Orleans, doing sex work and picking pockets, and who no historian had paid the faintest attention to. And she ends up owning a huge hotel and booking big bands, and Duke Ellington stayed there. And, you know, in that world, she was a much more important and celebrated person than any musician. But because the history of that world has been written by music fans, people like her have been completely ignored.
Now, like rap, blues and you know, the genres you're writing about were popular with whites, but there were some transformations for the white audience, right? What happened in this translation?
I have to say, that's a very, very messy question. I mean, yes, in both cases, you're dealing with kinds of music that clearly emerged from black communities and clearly fairly early begin fascinating white listeners. And the problem is in both cases, that goes in two directions. On the one hand, it has to be sanitized for the white mass market. And on the other hand, you have a white audience that likes to think of black culture as being wildly sexual and violent. So you also get, you know, Two Live Crew and NWA and all these groups who rather quickly in the rap world, you start hearing that they're selling better to white suburban kids than in black neighborhoods in some cases. And you get more and more cartoonish versions of rap that seem to be more and more tailored for that audience. And the same thing happened with blues, that you have these versions of particularly like Frankie and Johnny that start getting more, as far as I can tell, the early versions of Frankie and Johnny in the black community were not obscene, but you get more and more obscene versions being sung by white people as examples of, oh my God, those wild black people. And I have to say, as a historian, you know, I can guess, but it often is very hard to disentangle what's being cleaned up for white audiences, what's being made wilder for white audiences, and what is authentically part of the Black community. And, you know, I try, but I have no reason to think I'm getting it right all the time.
And at the end of the book, you talk about the pain that a lot of this emerged from. Could you talk some about that?
Well, yeah. You know, I think it felt very important to me to do, you know, as I've been saying in this, to celebrate the intelligence, the humor, the brilliance, the quality of the music, the quality of the lyrics, and the amount of agency that a lot of the sex workers had. And I just wanted to be very, very clear that I'm not saying this was all wonderful. And in fact, on the contrary, I'm trying to remind people I'm Jewish. And Jewish culture, it's a very similar thing. I mean, we've had a lot of great musicians and great humorists who came out of the fact that there's an awful lot of pain and that's how you deal with it. And that's true. I mean, soldiers' songs, coal miners' songs. I mean, the sort of humor that people use to get by and the sort of art they create to get by and to get through, I think it has a power that is very different from the power of just regular light pop music. And so I also, was trying to say this stuff is wonderful. The world is fascinating. That doesn't mean the world was wonderful. The world was pretty hellish to be actually in.
That was Elijah Wald, historian and musician and author of Jelly Roll Blues, Censored Songs and Hidden Histories, just out from Hachette Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, another track from Jelly Roll Morton's last sessions. This Whining Boy Blues, or Whining Boy. Whining might refer to Morton's drinking up the wine at closing time, but it also might be a euphemism for another of his nicknames, Winding Boy, which can either refer to a sharp, seductive style of walking or something even more overtly sexual. Wald quotes someone saying of the name, "He's a ladies' man boasting of his prowess. He's a winder, he's a grinder, he's a long-distance body soother." Till next week, bye.
And shake it like sweet slaving chains.